Nasser, this symbol of everything that's wrong with Islam, was captured in the Pakistani city of Quetta in late October of 2005. Now, this is well after he was implicated in the two most deadly terrorist attacks in Spain. This is after he was implicated in the deadly terrorist attacks in France. This is after he was implicated in sourcing jihadists to participate in 9/11. By the way, sourcing jihadists to participate in 9/11, training them to participate in 9/11 at a time that he is an avowed enemy of Al-Qaeda. And yet, this man, who is the most articulate spokesperson for Islamic terrorism worldwide, in late October of 2005, he was captured in Pakistan and was handed over into American custody. He was among 14, this article says, high-profile Al-Qaeda suspects. Now, what's stunning here is that he wasn't Al-Qaeda at that point. He was anti-Al-Qaeda. But his name was not among those transferred to Guantanamo Bay in 2006, where persistent reports are that he was one of the ghost prisoners in secret detention in Diego Garcia. On the 14th of April, 2009, Spanish magistrate sent out queries as to Nasser's location. Daniel Woodles, reporting for the Associated Press, said that Garzon, he is the magistrate in Spain, requested information from Britain, the U.S., Pakistan, Syria, and Afghanistan. The report stated that U.S. officials confirmed that Nasser was apprehended in Quetta, Pakistan, in November of 2005. The Spanish newspaper El País attributed Garzon's query to United States President Barack Obama's announcement that Guantanamo Bay's detention camp and CIA black sites would be closed. That they wanted him. You got him. You've admitted that you got him. Turn him over to us. However, at some stage, Nasser was released by the United States, given back to Syria. Returned to Syria, where he became a wanted man. He was free, however, in Syria as a wanted man. We just released him. In late 2001, rumors emerged that Abu Musab al-Siri had been released from a Syrian jail where he was briefly detained. This was confirmed in early 2012 by a posting on a jihadi forum. He simply changed names. Due to his prolific writings on strategic and political issues related to Islam and jihadism, and his guerrilla warfare experience as a mujahideen, Nasser was a popular lecturer and, to a certain degree, an unofficial advisor for a wide range of jihadi groups worldwide. Organizationally, however, he remained a rather independent figure. Yeah, he was associated with Islam, but with no Islamic terrorist group, including Al-Qaeda. His network, his connections were actually much broader than were Al-Qaeda's. His contacts exceeded by a considerable degree Osama bin Laden's or even al-Zawahiri. He played a role in encouraging the terrorist in Iraq, and his network of contacts was widely considered in Morocco, Algeria, Libya, Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, Kurdistan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Uzbekistan, and elsewhere. As a matter of fact, what's interesting here is that while the West kind of neatly wants to tie everything here that is happening, including the 9/11 attacks on Al-Qaeda, the far more inspirational, the far more well-connected, the far more responsible party was anti-Al-Qaeda. It's Nasser. Now, that's a stunning revelation. It discredits and undermines everything the United States has said. It's one of the reasons that the U.S. government released him. Because the truth here doesn't fit the American war agenda. It is acknowledged that one of his associates, one of Nasser's associates, the Moroccan Amer Azizi, who's also known as Uthman, had met the 7/11, the 9/11 organizers, including Mohammed Atta and Ramzi bin al-Sib in Tarragona. That's in Spain, weeks before the attack. Nasser's best-known work is his 1,600-page book, The Global Islamic Resistance Call, which appeared on the Internet in 2004 and 2005. In it, author Lawrence Wright reports that Nasser proposes that the next stage of jihad will be characterized by terrorism created by individuals or small autonomous groups, which he terms leaderless resistance, which will wear down the enemy and prepare the ground for the far more ambitious aim of waging war on open fronts, without confrontation in the field and seizing control of the land. We cannot establish a state, which is the strategic goal of the resistance. He has described the very thing that we are witnessing and has depicted the very thing that Americans can't seem to wrap their brains around. Now, if you look at the Boston attack, what you find there with Tamerlane and Jokhar is that they were leaderless. They were not part of any jihadi cell. They acted as lone individuals. Now, lone individuals in consort with Islam. That's what Nasser is writing here. That the strategy that needs to be played is that Islam remains supreme. Be a good Muslim. Be a terrorist. Act as a terrorist. But act as a terrorist without being part of a terrorist club, but instead as an individual. Because under that basis, other than to specifically identify Islam as the threat and to ban it, there is no way to stop its destructive assault against the world. You see, you can't lash out at a terrorist organization based upon the Boston bombing. So you can just say, oh, Boston, we're going to be strong, and oh, boy, he didn't get us down. And you go on to the next time that the terrorist attacks, like Nasser in Fort Hood, when he killed so many Americans there. You just go on to the next one because you can't be associated with any individual or any individual or unique terrorist organization. And on it goes, no matter where in the world. It's why you look at 9/11. It can't be associated with Al-Qaeda because the most dominant operative was an independent and anti-Al-Qaeda. If individuals who are motivated by Islam conduct acts of terrorism, there's no way for the world to fight back. There's no way to preempt them. There's no way to identify them. There's no way to go out and launch an offensive against them. His strategy, while perverse and destructive, while deadly and damaging, while poisonous and putrid, is brilliant. He came up with a plan that Muslims are following. It can't be resolved. You see, the only way that you could effectively fight that strategy is for Americas and European, Russian and Chinese, South American, the world's politicians, the world's media outlets, the world's militaries, collectively, the world's academics, collectively, to shed their ignorance, to put aside political correctness, to tell the truth, to reveal that Islam is to blame for 99% of terrorist acts and that Islam is a blight on the world. It's the most destructive and damaging and debilitating scheme that man has ever conceived. And that for the peace and security of the world, for the prosperity of the world, for the sake of the world's children, for the world's women, and for the lives of innocent people on this planet, that Islam must be banned. That it'd be the only way that you could effectively fight this strategy that is being articulated by Nasser. And there isn't enough wisdom, enough courage, enough devotion to good in any country, in any human institution, much less every country and every human institution, to accomplish this goal. Islam doesn't win as a result, but everyone loses. It's the nature of this religion. Terrorism, as Nasser correctly surmised, is its signature move. That's why Yahweh, depicting what's going to happen in Syria, depicting what's happening in Syria and what's going to happen in Israel and around the world once the Syrian war is over, speaks of the perpetrators, the militias, the Mujahideen, as Islamic terrorists. In fact, in the midst of the Hebrew word for terror, we find Allah's name. God was extraordinarily clear. He is among the few, however, that isn't burdened by political correctness, who is willing to tell the truth because it is the most merciful thing we can do. It isn't hateful, my friends, to expose and condemn Islam as the source of terrorism. It's merciful. We'll be back in a moment. The next line in Wikipedia's presentation of Nasser should send a chill up the spine of any rational American. He wrote that the American occupation of Iraq inaugurated a historical new period that almost single-handedly rescued the jihadi movement just when many thought that it was finished. Now, why would I say that should send goosebumps up and down your spine? America alleged that it was invading Iraq because it harbored al-Qaeda, that it was part of its war, global war against terrorism. And yet, Saddam Hussein was the most effective Middle Eastern potentate to quell terrorism. There were essentially no terrorist acts in Iraq under Saddam Hussein's rule. And then when America deposed Saddam Hussein, Iraq becomes the country of terrorism, where tens of thousands of Iraqis are murdered each year as a direct result of terrorist acts. And at the very least, the invasion was wholly counterproductive. But Nasser goes one step further. He said what I've said for 12 or 13 years now, that by responding to 9/11, by invading Afghanistan and Iraq, what we did is make Americans targets. We simply gave the jihadists the opportunity to be jihadists. We gave fundamentalist Muslims someone to kill to earn jihad points with Allah. It was the dumbest thing we could possibly have done. And it was just like Vietnam, where Americans flew airplanes over Vietnam, dropping napalm and Agent Orange and cluster bombs and white sulfur, all sorts of despicable stuff. And all the communists had to do is point to the sky and say, who's your enemy? Well, the same thing is true in the Islamic world. As the Americans brought their rifles and their bombs and their tanks and all manner of weaponry into that Islamic country and ravaged it, all the fundamentalist Muslims had to do is say, who's your enemy? And anyone fighting that enemy was a friend. It gave the Islamic jihadist enormous credibility and popularity. What we did was counterproductive. It was stupid. It was suicidal. Rather than fight the war on terrorism, we ignited it. NASA recognized it. Why is it that so few in America can recognize it? In early 2014, a top Sharia official in the Syrian jihadist group Jabhat al-Nusra, which is now the Islamic Front, it's the dominant group of, it's actually a coalition of Islamic mujahideen fighting against Shia Islam in Syria. This individual, Dr. Sami al-Aridi, who's the individual that we used to lead into this article, it's now closing with this reference, acknowledged that his group was most influenced by the teaching of Abu Musab al-Suri, who is Nasser. The strategies derived from Abu Musab's guidelines to win the hearts and minds of local Muslim communities are all derived from his writings, which are in effect derived entirely from the words and deeds of Muhammad. Wow. It's amazing what you can learn when only you try. This next story is a bit dated. It's comes to us from the New York Times. It is about a week or two old. The verdict in this trial was announced today. But I did want to begin sharing with you the trial and the indicted individual before we share the outcome of that trial. And here we find that the New York Times is reporting that it was hours after the World Trade Centers had been toppled that Suleiman Abu Ghaith was summoned to a meeting with Osama bin Laden. He recalled a three-hour or so drive into the night, finding the leader of Al-Qaeda in a cave in the mountains of Afghanistan. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We know for certain that Ramzi Youssef was the individual that was the mastermind of 9/11. He came up with a plan of training Islamic jihadists to fly planes into those specific targets. We know that Nasser, the spiritual leader of the Islamic Front in Syria, was most responsible for writing the books that inspired these Islamic jihadists. We know that in particular, the head of the Al-Qaeda Mosque in Hamburg, Germany, was an essential player in recruiting Muslims to participate in that attack. And yet, in this particular article, we find that Osama bin Laden's son-in-law, while meeting him in a cave in Afghanistan. He wasn't with him at the time of the attack, wasn't with him as Al-Qaeda had been briefed on the attack, that he just simply asked Abu Ghaith, the man who was in New York court, represented, by the way, by Cohen, a Jewish lawyer. And bin Laden wanted his opinion on what was going to happen next now that, you know, that the Ramzi Youssef-inspired event had taken place, what was going to occur. And because bin Laden was the most boisterous proponent of attacking America, Abu Ghaid said, you know, what's probably going to happen is they're going to kill you. That's what's probably going to happen. And that's what he told them. And Mr. Abu Ghaid said that he told bin Laden, America, if it was proven that you were the one who did this, will not settle until it accomplishes two things. They kill you and they topple the state of the Taliban. Of course, America never did prove that he did it. Never took bin Laden to trial. And if they did, they couldn't have proven that he did it. And then bin Laden reportedly says, nah, you're being too pessimistic. And he says, you asked my opinion, that's my opinion. In the weeks after September 11th, Mr. Abu Ghaid, who later became bin Laden's son-in-law, served as a spokesperson for him, amplifying some of his pronouncements, giving them voice, prosecutors say, to a broad range of recruitment for Islamic jihadists to wage war on the United States. In reality, all Abu Ghaid did was assist in the recording of bin Laden pronouncements. And bin Laden took credit for, if you will, 9/11. He didn't conceive it, didn't staff it, but he certainly took credit for it. And so this person acted as his press secretary, if you will. So taking a stand in a federal courtroom in Manhattan to defend himself against charges that included conspiring to kill Americans and providing material support to terrorists, a charge to which he was convicted, but folks, his job was unofficial press secretary, if you will. He is the most senior bin Laden advisor, and to say that you're an advisor because somebody asked you a question is a real stretch to be tried, much less testify, in a civilian trial in the United States since the attacks. And he offered an extraordinary look at bin Laden at the time, taking jurors inside bin Laden's cave in Afghanistan. After the drive from Kandahar, Mr. Abu Ghaid said that he found bin Laden in the cave in this very rough mountain terrain. He said, come in, sit down. Did you learn about what happened? Bin Laden told him. The defendant recalled his response to the questions. The decision by Abu Ghaid, a 48-year-old Kuwaiti-born cleric, so he's a Islamic cleric, to testify came 2 weeks into his trial in the federal district court. Late on Wednesday, the defense rested its case, and the jury is expected to begin deliberations, which it has finally announced its verdict, that being today, guilty on all three charges. Mr. Abu Ghaid had been in Afghanistan for several months in 2001, where he was delivering religious lectures in training camps, he said. On the morning of September 12th, he testified that in those training camps. So he is a religious preacher preaching the religion of Islam in the training camps in Afghanistan. They are religious retreats. In those videotaped speeches, the first delivered on September 12, 2001, as he sat beside bin Laden, Mr. Abu Ghaid praised the September 11th attacks and warned of others to come. Mr. Abu Ghaid's decision to testify gave federal prosecutors a rare chance to cross-examine someone who was close to bin Laden, as if bin Laden was the reason that these attacks occurred. Mr. Abu Ghaid said that under direct examination, for example, that bin Laden wanted him to lecture in the camps because the trainees had a hard life, and a little religion would do them some good. He says, I need you to change that, Bin Laden told them, Abu Ghaif recalled. He said Bin Laden wanted him to make them be merciful. Nothing better than a merciful terrorist, I suppose. Seizing on that moment, a prosecutor later asked Abu Ghaif, you're telling this jury that Bin Laden asked you to speak at those training camps where men were being armed and learning how to use guns because he wanted you to talk about mercy. Oh, yes, Abu Ghaif replied. Mr. Ghaith also testified on direct examination that he had no idea specifically that the 9/11 attacks would occur, saying only that he learned of them from the news reports. But on cross-examination, he admitted that in the training camps, he had heard that something might happen. Oh, boy, that makes you a co-conspirator, doesn't it? Yeah, something's going to happen. I said it right here on this air. Maybe I'm a co-conspirator. Something is going to happen. You heard it first here, folks. Until Mr. Abu Ghaith took the stand, his lawyer had given no indication that they were going to have their client testify. The defense strategy had been to obtain testimony of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the self-described architect of the 9/11 attacks. That's not true there, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. You simply picked up a copy of them during your visits with Ramzi Youssef in the Philippines. You know it. I know it. So does everyone who has bothered to study the history of 9/11. The defense argued that the testimony of Mr. Mohammed, given his vast knowledge of the operations, would help clear their client. But the judge, Louis Kaplan, would not allow Mr. Mohammed's testimony. Now, that's really interesting. So, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was far more senior in the Al-Qaeda operations, his testimony could not be considered. Now, I think I shared yesterday how horrified I have been recently when I've watched media presentations, news presentations of trials, and where juries have rendered irrational verdicts, and that many of the times the juries have rendered these irrational verdicts because judges had precluded testimony at the trial. I mean, there's no one's testimony who is more germane to whether or not Abu Ghaith aided and abetted the 9/11 attacks than Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, unless it would be Ramzi Youssef. And yet the judge would not allow the most important testimony at the trial. That's just stunning. Now, without that testimony, you can't render a verdict. Not an informed verdict. America's judicial system has become a farce. That's the reality. Asked by Mr. Cohen whether he had ever taken part in any plan to kill Americans or anyone else, Abu Ghaith said no. He also said that he had met Mr. Mohammed. This would be Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, but only engaged in casual talk with him. He denied that he and Mr. Mohammed had ever discussed any terrorist plot. Prosecutors have not accused Abu Ghaith of helping to plan or carry out the 9/11 attacks. But prosecutors have said that Mr. Abu Ghaith knew of the Al-Qaeda plot in which Richard Reed tried to blow up a transatlantic airplane with explosives in his shoes, an assertion he denied on Wednesday. You see, the shoe bombing is also directly attributable to Ramzi Youssef. It was not a member of Al-Qaeda. Ramzi Youssef came up with the plot and actually tested it in a flight over the Pacific Ocean from the Philippines to Japan, where one individual was killed. His concept was if you could put enough directed explosives in the shoes, then if that passenger sat directly over the wings, that would somehow pierce the fuel cells in those wings, causing the airplane to explode. Well, it failed, and he did away with that plot, and yet we're still required to take off our shoes as we board airplanes. There would have been absolutely no way that Abu Ghaith would have known of that plot, just as there would be no reason to suspect that he would have known about 9/11. He was not an associate of Ramzi Youssef. The government has said that in court papers, as part of his role in the conspiracy, what conspiracy? That he provided on behalf of Al-Qaeda, that he embraced its war against America and sought to recruit others to join in that war. Well, we'll speak on that when Shattering Myths continues, because this is hypocritical. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. During this trial, Osama bin Laden's son-in-law, a man who, by all reasonable standards, had played no role in the planning of any terrorist attack, and by all reasonable assessments, did not know about any terrorist attack in advance of it occurring. A man whose contribution to Islamic terrorism was the same as every Islamic imam in the world today. The same as Muhammad's, the same as the Quran's, which is to extol the merits of being a jihadist, to preach about how Allah wants Muslims to be terrorists. That was his crime. And he was convicted of that crime. The three counts include conspiracy to kill Americans. Yeah, the conspiracy, in this case, has to be Islam. The only thing this man preached was Islam. And so if there is a conspiracy to kill Americans, this man, Abu Ghaith, that is an Islamic imam, who is trained as an Islamic preacher, is part of a conspiracy that is deadly, that wants to kill Americans. And that conspiracy can be none other than Islam. He is said to have provided material support to terrorists. His only material support to terrorists, only, is Islamic preaching. Remember, he preached mercy to the Islamic terrorists in those training camps. And so, if he is to be convicted of supporting terrorists, then we must convict every Islamic preacher in the world. We have Glenn on the line. It's been an informative day, Glenn, don't you think?
Yes, I've got some that worked at double, so I was napping a bit earlier. Uh-oh. So I didn't catch the first one. Oh, yeah. But I've just...
It's worth the listen, and not because of anything that I revealed, but because of the... We did a thorough investigation, and I hope you do listen to the archive, a thorough investigation of who Nasser was and his influence in the march of Islamic terrorism and how that's having its effect on the world today.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You were speaking, you know, about him yesterday. So, yeah, definitely catch it on the archive. But I've also just been listening to a very powerful man who was educated in a Filipino madrasa in his youth speak of his intentions for changing the world's geopolitical landscape in concert with his European sympathizers.
Mm-hmm. But Barack Hussein Obama.
Oh, yeah, him.
Yeah, I cringed today when I heard him tongue lash the Russians again and saying that there'll be more isolation, more sanctions, more penalties, more punishment for the Russians if they don't change their course relative to the Ukraine. But they haven't done anything to the Ukraine. They haven't invaded the Ukraine. They haven't shot bullets into the Ukraine. They haven't bombed the Ukraine. They haven't claimed the Ukraine. They haven't interfered in Ukrainian politics. They have said they want nothing to do with the Ukraine. So I just don't get it. What's our rage?
Oh, that's disingenuous. Come on, those bastards want to deprive poor, starving Chevron of European, of Ukraine's, you know, petroleum reserves, and they want to deprive, you know, Germany of Ukraine's steel.
So we should not look at what Putin has said, that he wants nothing to do with the Ukraine. We should not look at where the Russian troops are, and they're not in the Ukraine. We shouldn't consider anything that they've actually said and done. We can peer into the man's dark heart, and we know this is what he really wants, and unless he changes his heart, we're going to punish the Russian people.
Look, pirates get pissed off when you steal two-thirds of their booty. And when all the good stuff was in Crimea to begin with, and they're not going to get to pilfer, you know, the Crimean Peninsula, well, the pirates are pissed.
So you can't, a group of people who share ethnicity can't vote of their own volition to unite with people of similar history and ethnicity, that if they vote to do so, that's considered illegitimate. And when a country accepts their vote without firing a shot, that's considered inappropriate?
Oh, come on now. Let's not pretend that those people are capable of conducting a reasonable election. I mean, let's face it, they only gave them two choices. They didn't give them any third option. And, come on, let's face it, that was red in his head. The fix was in.
Okay.
It was vote fraud.
And we're going to accept the government in the Ukraine and support it and provide it with billions of dollars when they didn't even bother with a vote. They just had a riot. We'll be back after the news.